If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Now, the problem is that particularly in the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a sort of boom in Templar nonsense.
Put it bluntly.
You know, the Templars must have had some secret. The Templars had the Holy Grail. The Templars had the Turin Shroud. The Templars knew the secret bloodline of Christ. The Templars existed in ancient Egypt and still exist today. And on and on and on and on and on it goes. And you can get super lost in all of that.
That was Dan Jones talking about the Knights Templar.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to a special extended-length episode of the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Today we're going to be talking about the Knights Templar, the medieval religious military order formed during the Crusades that have been the stuff of legends ever since. The Templars are the subject of a new book by the popular historian Dan Jones. And he joined us in our London studio recently to discuss their amazing rise and spectacular fall. Putting the questions to him was the historian, author and broadcaster Susanna Lipscombe. Now, as I mentioned earlier, this episode is rather longer than our usual ones, but Susanna and Dan's conversation was so fascinating that we felt it would be a shame to have to cut lots of it out. Anyway, here's what they had to say.
So, Dan, let's talk about your new book. It's called The Templars, The Rise and Fall of God's Holy Warriors, and it's coming out when?
It's coming out on September the 7th. In fact, by the time you listen to this, it might already be out.
And it's a nice big book. It's a hefty tome. Interestingly, that the English cover, or British cover, has... thinking too much about the Tudor period. The British cover has the white background and the red cross on it, which is good Templar colours. Mm-hmm. But the American edition is black with the red cross on it.
Also good Templar colours.
Ah, because the piebald flag.
Well, partly that, but also because Templar knights wore white uniforms with a red cross, and Templar sergeants and chaplains wore black uniforms with a red cross, or brown.
Is that some sort of... assertion of superiority from your US publisher?
Not really, because the Templar Knight would probably have been was a more prestigious position than a Templar Sergeant. I mean, I wouldn't overthink the white versus black. I think I've just got a sort of a colour palette for the US and a colour palette for the UK.
Okay. So give a sense of the ground that you cover, because there's a lot of material covered here and a lot of time. So just a brief outline to start.
So I've tried to cover the whole lifespan of the Templars, which is in the order of around two centuries. And, you know, from books like The Plantagenets and Hollow Crown, Wars of the Roses, I quite like those big blocks of time. I quite like epic storytelling over multiple decades and or centuries. And so the Templars are quite... the story appealed to me on one level because it is that sort of shape. You know, we begin the book in the aftermath of the First Crusade, which was 1096, 1099. So the book opens in 1102, right after the First Crusade. And it takes the story up to, and slightly after, in the final two chapters, 1307 to 1312, which was the period that the Templars were arrested and eventually disbanded.
And it's a rollicking good story. I mean, it's an extraordinary... it's not just rise and fall, actually. It's rise and fall. And so you kind of are carried along. And I mean, I've read it very quickly. It's really gripping. It's, you know, it's a great bit of storytelling and a great bit of history. I mean, what I was really struck by in the introduction is that you quoted one scholar who had said that a narrative history of the Templars would be misleading because it would create... an impression of teleology that, you know, that, and yet you have written a chronological history, as you say, because for those who like their history in sequence. So you've embarked on a challenge that few would take on. And I wondered, what are the difficulties of doing that? And why did you do so anyway?
Yeah, I keep doing this. You know, when I was writing Plantagenets, I went to it going, you know, isn't it so weird that for like decades and decades, no one's just written a sort of survey of the whole Plantagenet dynasty? And then you start writing, oh my God, now I see why. It's really difficult. And the same was sort of true. You know, I'd read obviously a lot of books about the Templars and very few. Probably the most recent one to be strictly narrative was Piers Paul Reid, which is now going for 20 years ago. And really all the best scholars of the Templars were shying away from trying to write this kind of narrative history. And there are some good, you know, reasons for that, and I can see why. It's Helen Nicholson, absolutely brilliant scholar of the military orders, who said that writing a narrative history of the Templars is difficult, going on impossible, because, you know, this is an organisation that spans multiple realms and countries, multiple generations, the experiences of Templars living in, you know, Ireland or Croatia or Spain or Hungary or France, or, you know, all of these differed wildly. And then you have the sort of the sharp end, if you like, of crusading in the Christian kingdom of Jerusalem. You know, this is a sort of patchwork of different experiences. And in some ways trying to, you know, I can see the argument that says you can't hope to encapsulate all of those experiences in a simple chronological narrative structure. But, you know, we're human beings and we like to tell stories. And I think I found a lot of the books I'd read about the Templars, whilst brilliant, somewhat indigestible, thematic, to the point almost where many of them just fall apart, and certainly not suited to the kind of audience I want to reach, which is people who are interested in history but don't have the sort of depth of knowledge to be able to sit down and digest a sort of heavy thematic book about a topic like this. And I want to write stories. I love writing stories. And stories progress generally, unless you're Christopher Nolan, in a sort of an accepted fashion of a beginning and a middle and an end. And so the job for me then becomes marshalling all of this disparate material into shape, making it digestible. I'm not saying that, you know, this is not a definitive or the definitive guide to every single person who joined the Templars' life experience. No one could write that book. I can only write this book and hope that, you know, if people wanted to explore different aspects of the Templars in more depth, or it's all there in the bibliography, the endnotes, you know, and in a bit in the introduction as well.
So we'll come back and talk about story later on when we've got a bit more into the material. But let's start, because you mentioned endnotes and the bibliography, by talking about sources. What are the sources for this period, for this history?
You know, I came to this book thinking that, in a sense, not really knowing. You know, I know the sources of medieval England quite well, and I know their strengths and their deficiencies. What I didn't have the same depth of knowledge in was the sources for the crusading period in general and the Templars in particular. With the Templars, you start with a gap, unfortunately, because the central Templar archive, once held in Jerusalem, moved to Acre, then to Cyprus, disappeared. It's gone. When the Templars were rolled up, the most likely thing I think is that it was left on Cyprus, but we don't know what happened to the Templar central archive. So you start from a position that doesn't look initially particularly promising, because the most important repository of information about the Templars in the East is hundreds of years gone. However, what you do have when you're writing about the Crusades is a brilliant literature of chronicle, which comes with its problems, problems of bias, problems of perspective, problems of historical structuring that was being deployed by the chroniclers themselves. But you have what I really liked about this is you have a great quote unquote Christian literature and a great quote unquote Muslim literature as well. So the Islamic writers in this period are brilliant. You know, absolutely brilliant, and then the chroniclers who were writing about you know, Egypt and Syria and what we now call sort of Palestine and Israel and Lebanon and so on and so forth are fantastic. And there is this sort of this poetry and playfulness to a lot of the chronicle material. We have voluminous accounts kept by people. You know, Saladin is a key character in the sort of mid part of this book that I've written, and you know, you have his secretaries and people around him writing first-hand accounts, so you know, you can feel very close to the character through the you know, the literature. There's a lot of good archaeological work that's being done in Israel at the moment, and then when we move to the sort of the back end of the story, when it comes to the trial of the Templars, there's a lot of trial documents. There are a lot of there's a lot of evidence from the trials. Now, again, you know, you come up against problems with all evidence, as you know, all sources. But I mean, there are particular problems with using the evidence of the trial of the Templars, because most of the literature was written by the people conducting the trials, all of whom had a vested interest in finding the Templars guilty. But you know, that's our job. Our job is to read between the lines, read against the evidence, and come up with what we feel like is a story we've unpicked from the sort of fake news of the period.
And so you're drawing on sources in. I mean, I noticed you've got, you know, as well as obviously English and translations into English, French, German, Latin sources in your bibliography. Presumably, ideally, one would be able to read Arabic, but there's...
I can't read Arabic, but there are good translations into English, French, Latin of the key Arabic sources, fortunately.
And one more question before we get stuck into the chronology, because I thought what we could do is we could go along and dip into bits of the chronology where it's just really fascinating, and then also come back to some more thematic questions. So one thing you do say also in the introduction is that you're not engaging with the mythology around the Templars, but... I do feel like I need to ask you if, as you were approaching this, were there particular things that you needed to slough off, particularly heinous or exaggerated or generally annoying myths about the Templars that you wanted to get out of the way?
Well, look, Templar mythology is great because it... So what do we mean by Templar mythology? Let's say people will have heard of the Templars, if they've heard of the Templars, because of Dan Brown, The Da Vinci Code, because of the video games Assassin's Creed, because of, well, the Nightfall, the big new History Channel show, which I worked a little bit on, which is coming out at the end of this year, which is all about the Templars. So the Templars are one of those few medieval organisations that has genuinely left an impression in popular culture today. You know, Ivanhoe, Foucault's Pendulum. Now, the problem is that particularly in the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a sort of boom in Templar nonsense.
Put it bluntly.
You know, the Templars must have had some secret. The Templars had the Holy Grail. The Templars had the Turin Shroud. The Templars knew the secret bloodline of Christ. The Templars existed in ancient Egypt and still exist today. You know, and on and on and on and on and on it goes. And you can get super lost in all of that.
And there's very much this sense that they're the kind of secret society, as you say, kind of out in the shadows, ready to come in. Like, they're like superheroes, they're like Marvel characters.
There's this idea of the Illuminati, that's connected with the Templars, the Rosicrucians. You know, there is nothing too mad about the Templars that you could make up that's not already been made up on the internet. Believe me. And all of that is great. And in one sense, it means that people have heard of the Templars. On the other hand, you know, I came to this material thinking, okay, the last thing I want to end up doing, you know, 3 years ago when I started writing the book, the last place I want to be in 3 years' time is in a straitjacket, in a padded cell, going, no, you don't understand. The Templars are still ruling the world. Like, I wanted to take all of that away and tell the authentic story. Now I was worried to begin with. I was genuinely worried because I thought, I mean, is this just not just throwing out the baby with the bathwater, but throwing out the baby, the bathwater, the bath, smashing out the bathroom with a sort of sledgehammer and coming away with some powdered bits of ceramic and plaster in your hands and presenting this as something acceptable. As it turned out, thank goodness, the real story is much, to my mind, much more exciting, entertaining and relevant. I know that's not a word we like to use too much in serious historical circles, but, you know, it has some resonance today. So I kind of just set all of the mythology aside until I was finished writing the story. And then I went back and I did two things. The first was I consulted to a multi-million-dollar Hollywood production that's all about the Templars and the Holy Grail. And so I sort of have paid my dues with the mythology, which actually we can talk about in a bit because there are interesting levels to it. And secondly, I then went sort of on a crash course of Templar madness and came up with some extraordinary things, you know, like the Mexican drug gang who call themselves the Templars. But we can get on to all that in a little while.
Okay, yes, let's do that. So let's get back to the real story and let's start with the establishment of the order. So talk me through the chronology at the very beginning.
Okay, like, simple steps. First Crusade, 1096, 1099, results in the fall of Jerusalem from its Muslim rulers. It's taken by Western Christians, who are described loosely as the Franks or the Latins, to differentiate them from the Eastern Christians, the Greek, you know, Greek Orthodox Syrian Christians. The fall of Jerusalem in 1099 is extremely encouraging to Western Christians. It's a sign of God's favour and so on. And it encourages a sort of travel boom, tourism boom of Western Christians going to Jerusalem to pray, right? You know, it's the centre of the world, literally. You know, you look at medieval maps, there's Jerusalem bang in the centre. It's the centre in a geographical sense. It's the centre in a spiritual sense, the spiritual made manifest through geography. There's a problem, you know. You're going to go to Jerusalem in the early 12th century. It is a dangerous place, and we have lots of travel diaries. Pilgrims kept travel diaries, you know, pilgrims from England, pilgrims from Russia, you know, dozens of these diaries of people travelling to the Holy Land in the early years after it's fallen to the Western Christians. And they all come up, you know, they all have a great time, but they all say the same thing. It's really dangerous, you know, and you walk along the roads and you see dead Christian pilgrims lying there where they've been murdered by brigands and just left to rot in the sun because it's too dangerous even to bury them, torn apart by wild beasts or just left, you know, left where they lie. So as well as Jerusalem falling, the Christians have set up four quote-unquote Latin states: Kingdom of Jerusalem, County of Tripoli, Principality of Antioch, County of Edessa. In all of these have what we would now call security problems. And so within the first 20 years, there's a feeling which is then put into action that something should be done. And what is done is a guy called Hugh de Pan, gets together with a few of his pals, knights who've been on crusade, mostly from the Champagne region of France. They get together in Jerusalem and say, hey, you know what? Why don't we set up a bodyguard, a sort of RAC, roadside rescue service for pilgrims? And they do that. They get approval from the King of Jerusalem, Baldwin II, he gives them somewhere to live in the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount, which is identified by the Christians of the time with the Temple of Solomon, as the building which is described in the Old Testament. And from their home in the quote-unquote Temple of Solomon, they become known as the Templars. So that's really where the story begins.
Okay, and so you've got this very much this sense of they're there to defend pilgrims. I mean, is it written in that they're there to defend Jerusalem and these kingdoms at first, do you think? Or is that does it expand to that definition?
The brief expands quite quickly. So the mission starts with defending pilgrims, and it quickly becomes defending Jerusalem, defending the roads, or rather, it first becomes defending the roads around Jerusalem, you know, manning kind of roadside castles, way stations. Then it becomes defending the territory. You know, you get mission creep. And so within a couple of decades, the Templars are not just there to guard pilgrims. They're there to guard, in a sense, Jerusalem, the kingdom of Jerusalem itself.
And what's distinctive about the Templars as a movement?
Well, in a sense, they're not wholly original, because in Jerusalem at the time the Templars were founded, talking about 1119, 1120, there was already a group we now call the Hospitallers. You know, there was the Hospital of St. John in Jerusalem. The men who staffed this hospital, I mean, literally a hospital for sick pilgrims, the men who staffed the hospital were starting to think of themselves as an order, were starting to live by a rule, and would eventually, like the Templars, take on a full-blooded military function. So in that sense, the Templars were not wholly original. However, you know, step back and think about what the Templars were, and we get into quite a radical phase of the history of Christian thought, which is less boring than that introduction makes it sound. The Templars are two things combined. They are, by selection, knights, trained killers, murdering bastards. They are also men who've decided to take religious vows, vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and live by a religious rule in obedience to the church. So what you're fusing to, they're not monks, they're often called warrior monks, they're not quite monks, but they're professed religious. So you've got a fusing together of the two big, or two of the big, types of orders of people in the Middle Ages, the warrior and the religious man or woman. And to put these two together is in some ways an impossible contradiction, because how can you be going around murdering other human beings, maiming, killing, slaughtering other human beings, and still claim to be following the teachings of Christ, who told his disciples to turn the other cheek, and, you know, and so on and so forth. This seems to be quite a contradiction, but through a lot of sort of chicanery and to my mind, actually, some sort of just barefaced cheek, it's decided that no, we've got a better idea. Actually, if you sign up to the life religious, then your violence, your murdering, your maiming can be to the benefit and the satisfaction of God, of Christ, and not to the detriment of your eternal soul. And so that by killing the enemies of the church, you will not be committing homicide, you'll be committing malicide, you know, the killing of evil. So yes. That's quite a radical idea.
Yes, it's a very clever distinction.
Endured to this day.
And there's also that in the council, which permits them to be established, has that if a cleric takes up arms in the cause of self-defence, that you quote, he shall not bear any guilt, which obviously self-defence here seems like it's possible to be sort of limitlessly expanded as necessary. And then they establish themselves under a rule. So there's this 68-point code of Templar conduct from 1129, which has some fun things in it. Can you talk us through any of that?
So 10 years after the Templars had been founded in Jerusalem, they were really going through a process of institutionalizing, and so becoming a proper organization with a uniform, with a kind of a code to live by. And in 1129, the Council of Troyes gets together back in Europe, and under the influence of one of the great kind of reforming, crusade-minded abbots of the day, Bernard of Clairvaux, they put together the first Templar rule, the Latin or primitive rule of the Templars, which is modelled heavily on the Cistercian rule. Bernard of Clairvaux was a Cistercian abbot. Cistercians were a very new order, which chucked out all the kind of the luxuries of Benedictine monasticism and came up with a very severe, austere way of monastic life. And Bernard of Clairvaux was the sort of forefront of this. And he modelled in his writing of the Templar rule, the Templars on Cistercians. So they were to wear white robes, for example, like the Cistercians. They were to pray an awful lot. They were to live in poverty. They were to live away from the company of women, you know, and so on. So all those kind of fundamentals of monastic life. And there are also some parts of the Latin rule that are now comical to us, but which had some meaning at the time. So Templars were forbidden to wear pointy shoes or shoes with laces because it was said that these abominable things belonged to pagans. Now, I'm not sure that that's not true. you know, I see you're
wearing laced shoes.
I'm wearing laced shoes and you're wearing pointy shoes. I mean, I consider myself somewhat closer to a pagan than a Christian. I think you're rather the other way around. But the both of us would have been wearing the wrong footwear to join the Templars. You know, ornate bridles and lances and so on were banned because these were knights, they were going to be riding horses. Anyone who asked for the best robes would be sort of slapped down and immediately given the worst. Now, when you first read those, and we can still read the Templar rule today, they look comical, they look silly. You know, what on earth is wrong with pointy shoes? But actually, this had a very clear purpose because the Templars were sort of an anti-knighthood. They were, in Bernard's mind, they were to the knight, the archetype of the knight was something faintly abominable. It was this kind of proud, arrogant, worldly killer. And he wanted to create a new knighthood, as he put it, that would reject all of the sort of the earthly trappings of knighthood and purify the idea. So that these would be knights who didn't flounce about on nice horses with fine, gaudy shoes and shiny armour and all that. They would get rid of all of that sort of flim-flam and go back to the purpose of what a knight really was, which was someone who did violence, and that violence would be turned to God's end. It came out of a monastic reform movement. It was an attempt to reform the office of knighthood at the same time.
Right, yes, so sort of taking off anything that might be proud or vainglorious. And you mentioned the chastity one. The line you quote from the rule is that the knights should avoid at all costs the embraces of women by which men have perished many times. Although it does quickly go on to rule out homosexual behaviour as an alternative, which we'll come back to. So what was the appeal of being a Templar then, given it's so austere as a code of knighthood? Why would someone go for it?
Why go for the Templars? Well, you know, I think that in this early period of the Crusade movement, which as a movement in general embraced lots of the ideas we've been discussing, is it possible to do violence that's pleasing to God rather than displeasing? There was a sort of mass crisis of conscience in a way. In quite a violent society, that it was people were becoming increasingly estranged from the possibility of salvation, and that if someone says, you know, knights, you know, if you spent your whole life pursuing a vocation which, at the back of your mind, you're aware is probably going to land you eventually with all the torments of hell, you know, with beetles gnawing your innards and being strung up by your eyebrows or your toes and roasted over the sulphurous fires and so on, whatever. If someone offers you the opportunity to sort of keep doing what you're doing, more or less, but reverse the sins of your life, then in a world in which the Christian worldview is all about salvation, that becomes quite appealing. I think the Templars were kind of pretty cool. I mean, that's not my opinion now. That's my speculation of the time, that here you have a kind of new army-ish, you know, paramilitary with kind of hip uniforms and a devout code of conduct. And it's, you know, I'm sure there is a crass parallel to be drawn with young men going off today to join IS, or the Peshmerga or whatever in the Middle East. And the sense that I'm going off to live in the Islamic State, I mean, I would consider that absolutely dreadful. However, that clearly appeals to certain particularly millennially minded, religiously devout young men.
Yes, and it's interesting, isn't it, given that the Templar flag, or, you know, black and white, it is about seeing the world in those terms. It's a condition of youth in some ways that you
yes.
that you want to join up to something that is so rigid and says what is right and what is wrong.
Yes. I think when you're young, you know, you do believe that the world is sort of divided into good and bad, and you have this sort of Nietzschean view of things. And then as you get older, it's usually about realising that's completely untrue. Maybe I just watch Game of Thrones too much.
So there's a spectacular growth of the movement from these kind of small beginnings. And reading about it, it does seem kind of stunning, almost that there's something supernatural about the velocity of their growth. So those first few years, how do they grow so quickly?
Well, the key to the Templars, their growth and their longevity, such as it was always donation. And a relatively small proportion of Templar membership were actually fighting knights. And so what you had was an organisation with a sort of sharp end, by and large, in the Holy Land and in what we now think of as Spain and Portugal, who were fighting, garrisoning castles, fighting in armies, whatever. But the organisation itself was much, 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 much larger, and it consisted in, you know, the non-crusading arenas and realms of England and France and to a little bit the Holy Roman Empire and Greater Italy and so on, of properties that had been assembled ultimately by donation. So ordinary people would donate to the Templars. Now, they could donate anything ranging from... You might die and leave your jacket or your horse, or if you didn't have a horse, you know, a share in a vineyard or whatever possessions you had, you might leave to the Templars in order to further their mission. That would be at the low end of the scale. At the top end of the scale, you could, before your death, you could go and join the Templars, and whether you were fit to fight or not, there would be a role for you within the Templars. Which was, I'll come back to. At the top end of the donating stuff scale, you have people like Alfonso I of Aragon, who left the Templars one third of his kingdom on his death because, well, for various reasons, but because he believed in the Templars' mission and wanted to bring the Templars into the Reconquista, the crusading movement in Aragon. So there was this sort of swell of donations, both large and small, which the Templars... put together in a network of properties and estates stretching right across Europe, you know, ultimately from, end up from Dublin, you know, from Ireland through to Cyprus, all of which were focused on making money. And that money was then funneled, or the profit, a third part of the profits were funneled to the crusading theatres where they funded the mission.
So money's part of it, and it is... Money's surprising, a huge part of it. And they're committed to poverty is one of their vows that they become so rich. Mm. But there's also, isn't there, independence from local bishops and influence?
Right. So that's another part of it. So early on in the Templars' history, there were a series of grants from the Pope, you know, papal bulls, which allowed the Templars the most extraordinary range of freedoms from oversight and from taxation. So in theory, the Templars as an organisation and the officers of the organisation were only supposed to obey the authority of the Pope. You know, they weren't in hoc to local kings. They weren't obliged to pay tithes, you know, the regular taxes that bishops and archbishops would levy as a matter of course on the people who lived around them. So really there were a few pillars of rapid growth. Widespread popularity, the appeal of the mission, so that even if people weren't joining the Templars, they were donating to the Templars. Freedom from taxation and regulatory oversight. Those are the sort of two pillars by which the organisation becomes rapidly quite rich.
And it's amazing how quickly that happens and how, you know, they're famous within 20 years. And trusted. I was really struck at the time of the Second Crusade, and you can tell us a bit about this. Louis VII of France is signing over command of his troops to the Templars. Could you unpack that a little bit? Because sounds extraordinary.
This is kind of the moment when the Templars come to the fore in terms of the history of the crusading movement. I think, so the Second Crusade, rough dates, 1147, 1148. Up to 1149. The Second Crusade marks the, you know, a re-emergence of the crusading movement. Huge armies sent from Germany and from France to the Holy Land to try and take back Edessa, which had fallen to Muslim armies. And up until this point, the Templars are a sort of interesting and relatively popular adjunct to the Christian Kingdom of Jerusalem, and they're involved in the crusading movement in Spain and Portugal. But their sort of their coming out moment, if you like, takes place during the Second Crusade. Now, the Second Crusaders, for the most part, decided to march overland to Greater Syria, to Edessa, to liberate Syria, which was a slightly questionable decision, but they were, you know, in terms of tactics and strategy, having to march miles through hostile territory. But burned in the minds of these crusaders was the success of the First Crusade, and they were trying to follow exactly what their forefathers had done. Now, as it turned out, that was not a very good idea. And the French component of the Crusade, led by Louis VII, got to Constantinople and then had to march through hundreds of miles through Asia Minor in order to get through the mountains down into Syria and to Edessa. And that proved quite difficult. And it proved quite difficult for a number of reasons. One of the reasons was a sort of a large crusade consisting of tens of thousands of people was quite difficult to marshal anywhere, let alone hundreds of miles through hostile terrain, because these were not regular soldiers, in many cases not soldiers at all. They were led by Louis VII, who, Eleanor of Aquitaine got shot of him, said was more like a monk than a king. You know, he was not by popular renown a very good soldier. So halfway through their march through Asia Minor, they were in very serious trouble, attacked by Turkish outriders, harassed. The army was breaking up effectively. Riding with Louis VII were roughly 50 Templar knights who'd come from Paris and were you know, part of this, a very small part of this crusading, this component of the Second Crusade. Things got so desperate as they were marching through modern Turkey that Louis VII kind of panicked. He was almost captured and killed himself, and he handed over control of his entire army to these 50 Templars, led by a Templar called Gilbert, or Gilbert, I suppose, who organised the army thus. He said he divided into 50 small units, each one of which was to be headed by a Templar, and they were given two days rudimentary training of what to do if the column comes under attack, which not rocket science, it's just don't run blindly around screaming with your hands in the air, you know, to paraphrase. Discipline, order, don't panic, you know, basic military training. Under attack, the Templars would command these units. If things got really bad, they'd form up into a single Templar unit and deal with the problem, and then they would slip back. So, and this was very successful. They managed to escort the crusade to safety, effectively, to the point where they could take ship across to Syria. And having got to the Holy Land, then managed to raise an enormous loan because Louis VII had basically gone broke on his way over there. So this was, you know, and we're talking about 1147, 1148 at this point, so just shy of 30 years after the establishment of the Templars, which is quite an extraordinary achievement to have gone from a handful of guys hanging around the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem saying, hey, you know what, we should guard pilgrims on the roads around Jerusalem, to the capability to march an entire crusading army through hostile terrain safely and then bail out their leader without going completely bankrupt, was quite remarkable.
And is this their zenith, do you think? This is, or at least in terms of, in military terms, over these years?
For me, it's one of the most extraordinary episodes. And it's the first big demonstration of what the Templars were able to do. And I think that from that point on, almost every crusade involved Templar forces, usually either riding rearguard or vanguard, They fought in most of the major engagements in the Kingdom of Jerusalem, in the two crusades which targeted Damietta in the Nile Delta. But for me, yeah, this moment in the Second Crusade was really an absolutely extraordinary demonstration of capability and of the trust that, as you use your word, that people were willing to place in the Templars, even at this early point.
And what's interesting is, because of course you're doing this story of the Templars along the way, but we learn so much about the Middle East as we go through. So all these, one thing I felt I was struck by was that, even as they march through, who they're fighting against, you're reconceptualising our ideas about the Middle East, reminding us, of course, that national boundaries are not sort of primeval entities, they're historic constructions. And so you've got all these kingdoms prevailing at the time of the Templars. Do you want to tell me a little bit about those? I hesitate to pronounce all their names. The Fatimite, is it Caliph?
It is very complicated. And changes throughout the run of the book. But, you start off... One of the reasons the First Crusade had been so successful was that in the Near East, the Islamic world was fractured. So you had the Fatimid Caliphate in Egypt, and then you had a sort of series of Seljuk kind of emirates and city-states, all with very fluid kind of borders, in Syria, Greater Syria, the Jazeera, Mesopotamia. And then you had a sort of Turkish, what was known as the Seljuks of Rum in Asia Minor. So you have all of this sort of patchwork of divided powers at the time of the First Crusade and really in the first half of the 12th century in the Near East. What changes and what really affects the future and the viability of the Crusader states is that from the 1160s, 1170s, the Muslim world in the Near East starts to consolidate once again under a series of rulers, Nuruddin, Saladin, Saladin's successors, and then in another revolution somewhat later in the 13th century, the Mamluk Sultanate. And both of those movements, the Ayyubids, who are Saladin's family dynasty, and then the Mamluks, a sort of slave soldier dynasty, originally who come out of Cairo originally, both of these managed to unite Egypt and Syria. And the geography of this is that the Crusader states, so they lose the county of Edessa quite early on, but you end up with three major Crusader states, Kingdom of Jerusalem, County of Tripoli, Principality of Antioch. These eventually become encircled and whittled away and whittled away and whittled away. And it becomes the case that the only way to defend these areas or to take back land that's been reconquered by the forces of Islam is to call for another major crusade. And as it turns out, there's only so long you can keep doing that.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So we have this period in the later 12th century when Saladin has risen to power, where the Western Christians in the Holy Land are under attack. Mm-hmm. So we have a series of, disastrous battles. And these are depicted with heart-wrenching stories, like Jacob's Ford or the Springs of Cresson, where you've got 140 Templars going against 7,000 of Saladin's men. I mean, it seems absolute madness. And then Hatton, the Horns of Hatton, is it? So there's, again, 40,000 or so, I think, of the Western Christians, the Franks, against Saladin's Saracen army. In fact, actually, there was this description. He had this description about the how he cut off the water supply, which I just thought was absolutely horrific. And maybe you can give us a bit of a flavour of that.
Yeah, so 1187, the Battle of Hattin, the Battle of the Horns of Hattin, is a pivotal moment in the history of the Christian, the Western Christian Crusader states in the Near East. Because in the decade or so prior to this point, Saladin, a great Kurdish kind of general who'd risen to power in Egypt and managed to unite much of Syria and Egypt, had taken it upon himself to start directly attacking with the aim of ridding the land of the Western Christians, the Franks. And this this coincided with a period of extreme weakness of rule among the Western Franks, kings of Jerusalem. There was a king of Jerusalem, Baldwin IV, who had leprosy. Then there was a child king. Then there was a queen who married a consort that divided the Crusader states politically. In 1187, Saladin took advantage of all of that and brought the Crusaders under King Guy of Jerusalem's leadership to battle at the Horns of Hattin on the 4th of July. Traditional strategy had dictated that the best thing to do was not to get into big battles. I mean, that's the best thing to do in the 12th century in general. If you ever find yourself transported back to the 12th century and someone says, hey, you want to come and join a battle, run away. Don't get involved. The answer is always no. Always just say no. But for reasons I just sort of describe at length in the book, mostly pertaining to pride, King Guy allows himself to be drawn into battle with Saladin, which is exactly what Saladin wants. And the descriptions of the Battle of Hattin are, as you say, I mean, they're horrible, they're horrifying, they're terrifying. The Christians allow themselves to be marched, drawn forward and forward, away from their supply of water, and eventually surrounded and cut off from any supply of water. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but it's kind of hot in the summer out in kind of, out in that part of the world. And the Crusader army, tens of thousands strong, very quickly becomes sort of depleted and weakened by lack of water. Around them, Saladin's men set fire to all the kind of the brush, the vegetation that's growing in this very dry climate. So they're not only thirsty, they're choked by smoke. And they're kept overnight from the 3rd of July to the 4th of July with their enemies close enough that they can taunt them, they can shout taunts at them. On the morning of the 4th of July, the army gets up and staggers a little forward. Then Saladin's men attack, and over the course of a fiercely fought battle, more or less annihilate the Christian army. The consequences, now the Templars are involved in this battle, and the Templars are heavily involved because the Templar master, Gerard of Riedfort, gives the sort of the wrong advice to King Guy, which is go fight. Gerard is captured, King Guy is captured, most of the other senior nobles among the Western Christians are either captured or killed. A lot of the Templars are killed. Those who are not killed and who are captured are brought before Saladin some days later. And Saladin decided, after the Battle of Hattin that he was going to deal with the Templars and the Hospitallers. He said, you know, these, because of the normal thing to do with captives is one of two things. If they're of low status, you sell them on the slave markets. If they're of high status, you ransom them back for cash.
Either way, you make money.
And that would have been the thing to do with the Templars, because these were high-value assets, if you like. These were elite military personnel with great value to the Kingdom of Jerusalem. But Saladin says, actually, he says, these two orders, the Hospitallers and the Templars, whose practices are unclean and who are basically never going to give up, we can't persuade them to convert to Islam. If we let them go, they're just going to come back at us. He decides to deal with them by killing them. And so he lines up around, he pays 50 dinars to anyone who brings him a Templar or Hospitaller alive, lines them up and has them beheaded one by one, but not by a professional headsman, by the kind of Sufis and, you know, clerics and anyone who's to hand who wants a go. It's like roll up, grab a sword, take a Templar's head off. And we have these descriptions by one of Templars, one of Saladin's associates who says, you know, in some cases they managed to do it. In other cases, they sort of freaked out and were totally ridiculous and had to be sort of, the job had to be given to someone who was better. So a real butchery of the military orders, which in Saladin's mind was going to fatally weaken the military capability of the Crusader states. Now, the one thing, Saladin understood military strategy extremely well, manifestly. But the one thing he didn't seem to understand was the nature of the military orders. Which had been understood by another one of their enemies, the Assassins, who actually didn't bother really to attack the Templars. And one of the key strengths of the Templars, which Saladin failed to grasp, I think, was that the membership individually was completely disposable, because the strength of the Templars existed in what we now call their brand, and it was a corporate strength. You know, no matter how many Templars you killed, they were strong enough throughout the 12th and 13th centuries to resupply, to re-up, to bring new recruits, new resources, and just sort of spring back.
Yes, they regenerate. They do often have this kind of sense of there being this many headed hydra. You know, they'll just keep on coming back.
They'll just keep on coming back. And that's why, you know, slightly earlier in the 1160s, the Assassins, you know, this sort of Shia sect of... literally assassins. We call them sort of terrorists now, but they specialised in spectacular public execution of famous political leaders on the Muslim and Christian side. They just didn't bother with the Templars, because they realised straight away, you know, you kill a Templar, there's another one going to take his place. It's like whack-a-mole, you know?
In fact, the Assassins are one of a couple of groups who look a little bit like Islamic equivalents of the Templars at the time, in that they're warrior castes, essentially, and they have a calling to do that. And later you have, the Mamluks, basically, yes. Sort of sect of the Mamluks.
That's right. You know, if we move forward into the 13th century with the next great sort of unification of the political territories in Egypt and Syria, it's done under the Mamluks, the Bahri el Mamluks who came, the River Mamluks, who'd come out of Cairo. If you watch Game of Thrones, it's the Unsullied, basically. You know, they're slave warriors who are usually kidnapped as children. From the steppe, brought down to Cairo, trained as sort of elite, hardened warriors. There are significant similarities between the Templars and the Mamluks in that they are both a kind of warrior elite. They are highly trained. They both have military manuals set up to lay out their military protocols. They have this sort of fearsome reputation which goes before them. I think the one difference between the Templars and the Mamluks, and by the way, this also applies within the Christian world, and I think is one reason why the Templars fall, whereas other military orders don't, is that eventually the Hospitallers and the Teutonic Knights found territory of their own. Now, the Mamluks ruled territory. They were the rulers of Egypt, this particular group of Mamluks became the rulers of Egypt and Syria, and a big empire stretching out therefrom. The Hospitallers in the 14th century became the rulers of the islands of Rhodes and subsequently Malta. The Teutonic Knights, a German or Germanic military order set up in 1191 or thereabouts in Acre, eventually became rulers of Prussia. They, you know, they had territories. The one thing the Templars never had, or only very, very, very briefly had, was territory that they ruled as a military state. There was a moment in the 1190s when Richard the Lionheart arrived in the East on the Third Crusade to basically stop Saladin. On his way to the Third Crusade, he came via Sicily and via Cyprus, and he conquered Cyprus from its Greek rulers. And having conquered Cyprus, realised he really didn't want Cyprus, so flogged it to the Templars. The Templars, for not much more than a year, occupied Cyprus as its rulers, but quickly fell into disputes. Didn't want to have to deal with the hassle of ruling Cyprus, and so sold it on to the Lusignan family, the family of King Guy, who had led the Christian armies at the Battle of Hattin 3 years previously. Now, Cyprus became a Christian kingdom. And eventually, you know, after the Crusader states on the mainland fell, it became the heart of the Christian, Western Christian kingdom in the East. But the Templars had got shot of it almost as soon as they'd had it. Now, I think had they not done that, had they found a way to occupy and rule Cyprus, they would have had a political and a geographical base from which they could have operated, which would have made them far less vulnerable to attack when it came at the start of the 14th century. But they didn't, you know.
Okay, so you've introduced Richard the Lionheart, and actually one of the ways that you introduce him in the book, you basically introduce him as a torturer, which I think was kind of interesting to lead into this well-known character with this story of the awful things he does. But he's arriving on the Third Crusade because Saladin has managed to recapture Jerusalem after something like 100 years. And so then we enter this period where it's all, there's quite a lot of toing and throwing. There are a lot of battles in this book.
And throwing is the lifeblood of the Crusades.
It is the lifeblood of the Crusades. But the background to this also is that the Templars are absolutely enriching themselves. You go and you do a bit of a survey of this period of at the very end of the 12th century, beginning of the 13th century, and the sort of amazing amounts of wealth that they're acquiring. And also, we've still got the parallel story of the Crusades. I don't know what you want to pick up on. There's so much material. Because this is also a history of the Crusades, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think this is one of the things I wanted to do with the book, or I realised that I would end up doing with the book, to form it into the narrative shape I wanted, was that this is, as well as a history of the Templars, it's a history of the Crusades through the Templar eyes. Mm-hmm. And that's what gives you this sort of narrative flow. Now, the 13th century is a period where the crusading movement starts to fragment. So in the 12th century, the late 11th century is the First Crusade, mid-12th century, Second Crusade, late 12th century, 1190s, Third Crusade, led by Richard the Lionheart, Philip Augustus of France, and so on. Now, we've just described the slaughter of the Templars by Saladin. Richard the Lionheart arrives in the Third Crusade to win back territory from Saladin and does so with some success, although they never take back the city of Jerusalem. But it's a kind of revival and a re-energising and a reclamation of the land of the Crusader states. And Richard has the same effect on the Templars. He brings with him new leadership for the Templars, drawn from his own circle of followers in France, where obviously he ruled quite a lot of territory. And the Templars from this point start to rebuild. And then the Crusade, I think, you know, to cut a long story short, the crusading movement from the Third Crusade, we skip the disaster of the Fourth Crusade, which sacked Constantinople, but the Fifth Crusade down to the Nile Delta, which attacked Damietta, 1218, 1219, 1220. The Templars are then fully involved once again, and they're a regular part of the armies of the Crusades, and they're sort of elite soldiers within those armies, and their masters have very high status and are often called upon to advise by usually the Western kings or high status nobles who are leading the Crusades. So if we get through, you know, if we move to the middle of the 13th century, when Louis the Ninth, Saint Louis of France, is leading crusades again. You know, leads a crusade to Damietta in the Nile Delta. He's using Templars to plan, to acquire boats, to give him advice while he's on campaign. When Louis's captured in Damietta and is held for ransom, he turns to the Templar. He can't pay the ransom. Is, you know, about £30,000 of silver short of paying the ransom, turns to the Templars. They're able to pay his ransom off the cash they've got sitting in boats in the water just outside Damietta. So, you know, add on to all of that, their involvement in the crusading movement comes much more than an auxiliary or an elite sort of military component. They start to be heavily involved in the funding and the financing of crusades. So we have letters from Pope Honorius III at the time of the Fifth Crusade, you know, first half of the 13th century, which tell us that Templars were being used to collect crusading taxes, and not just to collect taxes, you know, in England, France, Hungary, Spain, whatever, but to move that money down to Egypt without it having to go through Rome, so that people won't complain that the Pope's siphoning it off. He says that the Templars and the Hospitallers, he says, are the organisations he trusts best to perform this task. And they, indeed, they not only were they trustworthy, they had a capability, thanks to their sort of organisation, the spread of their organisation, the structure of their organisation, to move large sums of money around, which is one of the reasons why the Templars have acquired a reputation as, quote-unquote, bankers. Now, that's a word I use as the sort of section title of the third part of my book. It's a word that I thought sort of long and hard about, because I think that the Templars were more than just bankers. You know, the image we're often presented with of the Templars is that they were the world's first bank. And that meant that, you know, you put your money down in London and they were like an ATM. You took it out in Rome or Jerusalem if you presented a sort of a coded chit of paper, of parchment or whatever. Not quite so. That was not what the Templars specialised in, really. Yes, you could deposit things with the Templars. King John of England deposited the crown jewels with the Templars at one point because the Tower of London was out of his hands and not a safe place to keep his stuff. You could deposit charters, valuable stuff you could deposit with the Templars, partly because their buildings were religious buildings and it would be sacrilegious to attack them.
And partly because they're paramilitary.
They're paramilitary and you'd be mad to attack them. But they were more into what I'd call financial services, or what today we'd call financial services. So tax collection, you know, that's a really complex business. I mean, paying your taxes is hard enough. I complain bitterly about it, although I do it. Collecting taxes, I mean, a total nightmare. But the Templars are trusted to undertake the business of actually going around getting hard currency as taxation, accruing it, moving it. In France, for about 100 years, in Paris, the temple now gone in Paris, subcontracted effectively all the treasury or a large swathe of treasury functions from the French crown. That sounds kind of dry, but when you think about it, it's like a private company taking over HMRC. Now, the complexity of that business is sort of mind-boggling. We have the we have the Templars running accounts for the king's mother-in-law in France. We have, you know, we have the Templars looking after, you know, when Henry the, moving back somewhat back into the 12th century, when Henry II inadvertently had Thomas Becket killed in 1170, his penance was to give a large amount of money for the funding of a crusade. That was deposited with the Templars because they were the people who was thought would be able to, A, keep it, and B, would know what to do with it. So it's a dizzying array of financial services that the Templars were able to provide. And I think that's a better description than simply thinking of them as a bank of deposit and withdrawal.
But bankers is a shorter phrase than
financial
services.
Bankers is a nice short
term,
and we know what we sort of mean. I mean, you think, what would you call Morgan Stanley? Bankers, right? And in the same range of activity was in the medieval world. What the
and large-scale estate management and raising of loans and transferring. I mean, it's vast, this mm-hmm. scale of operations. And which one of the things which makes you think of the point that at Damietta, one of the people you have appearing in your vast cast of characters is Francis of Assisi.
Yes.
Whose real name I didn't know. Giovanni di Pietro di Bordone, something like that. I didn't know that before anyway. So that's interesting. He appears and he... is such a contrast to the Templars, who've been set up as this kind of radical ascetic form of knighthood, that it makes it them look like they've really diverged from their rule. That actually, you know, that there and there have been accusations along the way at certain battles that they have been precisely what they shouldn't have been. They've been vainglorious, they've been greedy, and that's why they've lost various battles.
Yeah, I mean, I loved that moment with Francis of Assisi turning up at the Fifth Crusade. And so Francis of Assisi, you know, at the beginning of the 13th century, just as the Templars had come out of a period of monastic reform and a feel that, or in part, and a sense that things should be, you know, we should get back to our roots, humility, poverty, chastity, piety. That comes round again. It comes round again in the 13th century, and you have the rise of the mendicant orders, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, and so on. And there's this wonderful moment. I mean, wonderful for me, because when I start a chapter of this, I think, when I'm always looking in telling stories like this for illustrative moments. And I think there is a great illustrative moment when Francis of Assisi appears at the Fifth Crusade. He comes to Damietta, and everyone's like, oh, my God, who are you? He says, look, I've come, you know, I'm going to go and talk to the Sultan, who at this point is Alcamil, one of Saladin's nephew. Don't worry, I'm going to sort all of this out. And they say, you know he's going to chop your head off. I mean, we really, really advise you not to go and talk to the Sultan. He says, no, I'm going to go and talk to the Sultan. So off he pops to talk to the Sultan. And the Sultan's just amused, like, because he comes along and says, have you thought about Christianity?
Yes, you know? You've noted that he's quite a poor preacher. He doesn't convert.
He offers to, you know, walk on hot coals to prove, you know, this, that, and the other. And the Sultan sort of sends him back with a smile on his face, I think. But there is this great moment, because the letters back from Damietta are all sort of full of these asides going, you know, it's a real nightmare having Francis of Assisi around, because all the young lads on crusade, now they want to go off and join the Franciscans, and they think he's kind of cool and hip and the best thing since, you know, sliced bread. And this contrasts brilliantly with the status of the Master of the Templars, who at Damietta, well, if we read the rule of the Templars, you know what the master is allowed as part of his office of being master. It is, you know, numerous horses, about a sort of enormous bevy of assistants, a strong box to keep the valuables in, you know. And so even though each Templar was still, in theory, sworn to vows that looked very much like those sworn, the way of life that was adopted by Francis of Assisi, barefoot, sackcloth and all, actually, when you step back and look at the Templars at this point, they're an incredibly wealthy, highly sophisticated paramilitary with a sideline in financial services. I mean, you couldn't get much further from the image which was summed up in the seal of the Templar master, which was two brothers sitting on a single horse.
Mm. And so moving on through a little bit, because we're trying to cover two centuries here, which obviously you go into a much more detail in your book.
Tudors never got to two centuries, did they?
No, they didn't, but it's okay. I'm happy to move outside the Tudors occasionally. so we've got the Sixth Crusade, and this is 1228 we're up to, and we've got, briefly, there's a deal between Frederick II from the Holy Roman Emperor
Alcamil,
who's the leader of the Akkadids at this time, is that right?
One of Saladin's successors.
So Alcamil gives Jerusalem back to the Christians, 1229, for a while, and then it's lost again. I'm summarising briefly. Want to come in here?
No, I think this is a very interesting moment, and this is a moment of great pragmatism during the Crusades, when Frederick Hohenstaufen, the Holy Roman Emperor, who'd been excommunicated four times.
That's impressive.
Even
Henry VIII didn't get that.
No. Turns up as the sort of leader of the Crusades, but also to claim the Kingdom of Jerusalem on the part of his son. Now, Frederick's sort of heart, in a way, lay in Sicily. And anyone who knows about the history of Sicily knows that this is the kind of point at which Islamic culture, Greek, Latin, Christian, all kind of blend together. And Frederick kind of embodied that kind of mishmash of cultures and was what we would now call extremely open-minded culturally. So he manages to cut a deal for Jerusalem, realises very swiftly, we're not going to go and conquer back Jerusalem. So he manages to cut a deal with the Sultan Al-Kamil that says, OK, look, we're not going to take Jerusalem back, but can we part occupy it and have access to our pilgrims? And they do a deal. And this you think would all be grand. But unfortunately, Frederick falls out quite dramatically with the Templars while he's in the Holy Land, and enters what amounts to a running war with the Templars whilst doing a deal with the Muslim Sultan. And it doesn't look great, and the chroniclers of the Holy Land give him absolute pelters for it. I mean, he's literally pelted out of the Holy Land, decides to leave shortly after cutting this deal with Al-Kamil, and they're throwing kind of tripe at him down at the docks as he's getting the
boat. Yes, it's a lovely line. I'm going to try and find it while she keeps saying that.
And I think this is, in one sense, a moment that we would now applaud. You know, it's diplomacy triumphing over militancy, and Jerusalem is, for a short period, for about 15 years, the Christians gain access to it. It is, you know, there's a sort of rapprochement between the Ayyubids and the Christians of the Holy Land, but it really doesn't it doesn't last, because 1240s, 1250s, 1260s, we have the rise of the Mamluks, and things get a little more dogmatic.
Yes. So there's this wonderful line where you say that Frederick II had come to the Holy Land with kisses raining upon his knees, departed it with offal hanging from his shoulders. It was a miserable way to go. And it's that sort of wonderful picture that really takes you into the heart of things. Talking of illustrative moments, one I particularly enjoyed was when we get to Louis IX, mm-hmm. Who built, you tell us, Saint-Chapelle and Aigues-Mortes, you know, I didn't know that either. His deathbed recovery. You open a chapter looking at his deathbed recovery in 1244. This astonishing moment, which gives him the inspiration to go off and have another go in Damietta. Tell us about that.
Well, Louis the Ninth, I think Voltaire considered him, you know, he was not an enormous fan of the monarchy, but you know, he was considered the kind of the great man in the history of the French monarchy. Cultured, saintly, urbane, kind of high achieving, a crusader. And it's, you know, had much written about him in and after his lifetime. There's a lot of propaganda about Louis the Ninth, so you have to take this slightly with a pinch of salt. But it, you know, it said he suffered from dysentery on and off throughout his life.
There's a really terrible bit.
During the crusade, during his crusade to Damietta, he has to sort of cut a hole in his trousers because his dysentery gets so bad. But he's at one point in his life, just shortly before he goes on crusade, he's in the 1240s, he's dying. And he's lying on his deathbed, and they brought down all the relics they can think of. And this is a man who collected a lot of relics. You know, he built Saint-Chapelle to house his relic collection, which had at its heart the crown of thorns. He's lying on his deathbed. Oh, no, it's so terrible. There's two women kind of standing next to him, and they're having an argument about whether he's dead or not, which I think is, you know, if you're not dead, is annoying. and they start to pull the sheet up, and then finally he suddenly just wakes up, and so it's said in one sort of somewhat hagiographical account of his life, he asked for a crusader's cross. And, I mean, this seems to happen quite regularly, or certainly it's a trope of accounts of great leaders during the Crusades, Saladin included, which is to say they have a terrible illness, recover, and then suddenly realise what it is they haven't done they're supposed to do, which is to become a great sort of bigot and kick the other lot out. And Louis the Ninth has it go through exactly this process on his deathbed, not dying of dysentery. No, he's not. And off he goes down to Damietta, and the Templars help him raise his army, fund his army, fight his campaign down in Damietta. And just like the Fifth Crusade down to Damietta, they get to Damietta, take Damietta, but no, they're not satisfied with Damietta. Someone has the bright idea that they should travel up the Nile to Cairo and take that as well. And again, you know, I gave you some advice about what you should do in the 12th century earlier. Well, if you find yourself in the 13th century near Damietta and someone says, do you fancy a day trip to Cairo? Again, the answer is no, don't do it, because history suggests that when you do that, you end up swamped in the floods of the Nile and in retreat. And that's exactly what happens to Louis.
And you know, if there's one bone to pick with you, or at least the history, there aren't that many women in this book, are there?
But no, there's not. There's not women. And I sort of really felt that all the way through. But what do? You write about the Templars, you know?
Yes, I mean, good on other forms of diversity, but not a gender. But we do have one. We've got Margaret, the wife of Louis IX, who is accompanying him on this crusade. And not only that, but giving birth to a couple of children along the way. It seems to me pretty impressive.
It's very impressive. And one of the children was the master of the Templars at the time, was Reginald Vicheux, stood as godfather to Louis's son, which was specifically mandated against in the Templar rules. So he really oughtn't to have been doing it. But as we all know, rules are there to be broken.
So there are lots of unpleasant rule-breaking people in this book. In fact, I'm not quite sure how you kept track of your huge cast of characters. But although I don't wish to imply that they're not, you know, they're introduced brilliantly, and I there were moments where King Amric of Jerusalem was a struggler, you said, and then go on to this wonderful description. So everybody who's introduced in this book, there's
large,
amazing,
pendulous breasts like a woman.
Yes.
That was Amric of Jerusalem. That was what William of Tyre said about him. He had a sort of stammer. He was quite awkward in conversation. And although he was very sparing with his diet throughout his life, he had blubbery pectorals which hung like a woman's breasts.
Exactly that. So we get these amazing descriptions
Dad
of people.
They call that now.
Where, so as you meet people, you remember certain things about them. Amric, his breasts. But there are pretty unpleasant and horrible people in this book. Who do you think is the most terrible of all?
Philip IV.
Ah, right. Okay. Yes.
I mean, so Philip IV, King of France, Philip le Bel, Philip the Fair, Philip the really, really, really weird, nasty piece of work.
So we're fast-forwarding through the end of the 13th century, where we have this great Mamluk surge taking back all sorts of lands, and fast-forwarding right up to the beginning of the 14th century, 1307, where Philip IV, the Fair, is not so fair to the Templars. What happens then?
Well, look, we're into the phase of the fall of the Templars, and I think, you know, there's a reason why I've written a book about the Templars and not about the Hospitallers, the Teutonic Knights, the Sword Brothers of Livonia, the Order of Belchite, whatever. There were lots of military orders in the 12th, 13th, 14th centuries. Only one of them was destroyed spectacularly by a vindictive King of France and his poodle Pope. That was the Templars. So just by way of quick backstory, 1270s, 1280s, the Mamluk slave soldier caste dynasty from Egypt conquer Syria, kick the Crusaders out of the Holy Land. They end up in Cyprus. Last stand, 1291, at Acre, siege of Acre. Templars are, the Templar fortress on the docks of Acre is the last line of defence, but eventually that falls. It's evacuated. Everyone ends up in Cyprus. That's 1291. The next 15 years see a sort of rolling hostility build towards the military orders in general and the Templars in particular. The Templars, led shortly after the fall of Acre by Jacques de Molay, James of Molay, the, as it turns out, last master of the Templars. In 1306, James of Molay is summoned back to Europe by the Pope, Clement V. Clement V, a Gascon, so a sort of Frenchman, but also a sort of Englishman, you know, Gascony then being ruled by England. He's summoned back to give the Pope some advice. Some advice on what should be done to reclaim the Holy Land, what kind of crusade needs to be launched, but also to defend the charge that's been building from several quarters, that the Templars and the Hospitallers should be rolled together in a single military order, a sort of super order, that would be led by a warrior king. And this idea is something that Philip IV, then King of France, grandson of Louis IX, latches onto. But as it seems, Philip IV, a cold, conniving, ultra-pious, this is bad history to diagnose, but, you know, as shorthand, somewhat psychopathic King of France, latches onto the idea of destroying the Templars for a number of reasons. Now, it's usually said he owed the Templars a bunch of money. Not quite so. The Templars had been running treasury functions for the kings of France for about 100 years. So the kings of France were always in debt to the Templars, but it was a sort of free-flowing debt, a bit like one of those bank accounts where you can dip in and out your mortgage, if you want a good analogy. So Philip was also... He was broke. I mean, there was no doubt he was broke. He'd wasted a lot of money. The French crown had wasted a lot of money fighting on the southern borders against Aragon. And they'd been continually debasing the coinage, you know, ruinous economic policies. Combine that with a lack of silver in Europe in general. They couldn't make any more coins. So Philip had a big financial problem. He was also engaged in long-running row with the papacy, and he'd had such a row with Pope Boniface VIII, who died in 1303, that he'd sent one of his ministers down to the Pope's residence at Anagni, and the minister, William of Nogaret, had slapped the Pope, so it was said, in the face, which you're not supposed to do to the Pope, and the Pope had died ravingly mad. Philip refused to drop it.
From a slap?
He slapped him, after besieging the house. Boniface died not long after. It used to be said that he died, he went mad and chewed his own hands off, but that's not true. They dug him up and his hands were still on. Philip IV... He was refusing to let this drop. He wanted to be, you know, Rex Christianissimus, the most Christian king. And that put him at odds with the papacy. And he wanted Boniface dug up and put on trial for sodomy and heresy and all sorts. 1306, in a sort of dual attempt, so the row with the papacy had basically been about money, and he turned it into a row about who was the most Christian king. 1306, he decided to swipe all the money from all the Jews in France by kicking 100,000 Jews out of his kingdom, take their money, also positioned himself as a sort of the most pious king in Europe. 1307, he decides to do the same thing to the Templars. The Templars have copped a lot of flack for losing the kingdom of Jerusalem. They also, as he knows very well, have a lot of wealth. And so a plan is slowly put into motion while the last master of the Templars is in France in 1306-7 to arrest all the Templars in France, put them on trial for a range of charges, all of which will centre on accusations that they've broken their vows, effectively, that they're corrupt, that they're blasphemers, that they're sodomites, that they're heretics. So Philip will be positioning himself as the sort of as a kind of cleaner upper of the church. He will also then be able to swipe all the Templars' money. And on Friday, the 13th of October, 1307, that plan swings into action. At dawn, royal officials all over France, who'd been issued their instructions a month previously, turn up at all the Templar houses in France, most of which are unguarded because France is not a crusading war zone, arrest all the Templars, take them off, imprison them, torture them, start putting them on trial, accused of an enormous range of outrageous crimes.
Yes, it does seem that Philip IV has something of an obsession with sodomy, particularly because it does keep coming up in these accusations. In fact, the list of things that the Templars are accused of, as you say, map so exactly between various interrogations that it's almost as if they're being given a list and being required to say yes. And so these things are heretical ritual. Homosexual practices, various abominations, in inverted commas, that they name. And this particular fascination with a kind of secret ritual at the beginning of their ceremonies, isn't there?
It's fake news. It is quite clever. So what the Templars are accused of is stuff that they've done which is made to sound terrible. So... one of the central charges is connected with the Templar induction ceremony by which new brothers were admitted to the order. So at such a ceremony, a Templar would be sort of made to wait outside chapter while all the other Templars had a meeting. He'd then be invited in, he'd be quizzed, he'd be told what a nightmare it was being a Templar, was he sure he wanted to do it, is he married, you know, asked a bunch of questions. Once he'd made it through all these, he would be admitted to the order and given the kiss of peace. Okay, in sort of normal run of feudal relations in the early 14th century, a kiss of peace between two men was nothing really to get too worked up about. It happened all the time. much as sort of an air kiss at a fashion show does not imply anything more than, you know, a greeting today. Now, the accusations against the Templars took that and ran with it. And they said, you know, these guys have been kissing each other. Oh, my God, they've actually been kissing each other. They've been kissing each other on the chest, on the lips, on the penis, on various other parts of the body. The Templars were also accused of forcing each other to deny Christ. There's a little bit of debate about whether perhaps that was a sort of test that was applied in some areas to some Templars, but it's not entirely certain. They were being accused of having worshipped kind of false idols, which sound pretty much like it's taking reliquaries, which would have been in some Templar houses, and saying, you guys have been worshipping worshipping the master, making a false distinction between veneration and worship. So they're accused of a bunch of stuff that's massively, massively, massively trumped up, tortured in large part into admitting that this is what they've been doing, and then paraded around in public at sort of a public inquiry where the most susceptible or high-profile Templars are forced to admit that they've been doing this stuff in public.
And it's once having worked on things to do with witchcraft trials in the 16th and 17th century, you know that where confessions happen is where inquisitorial justice is in play, where there's torture happening, and what it does to a person in terms of, it's not just about making the pain stop, it's about, it breaks down your sense of what you've done and what you haven't done. Mm. So people being accused of these things start to believe, well, maybe I did do them, because, you know, they'll just be led, and there's all sorts of interesting literature about it, but wanting to please your captor, mm-hmm. and wanting to say the thing he wants you to say and all this sort of stuff. So it makes sense that these Templars who are imprisoned and cold and isolated and hungry, and this goes on for years in some cases, are saying what, for the most part, they're being told to say.
Yeah, there's testimony from one Templar who says, in France, who says that he'd rather have been, you know, burned to death or boiled to death and put back in the little pit in which he was kept, which he couldn't stand up properly or sit down properly. And you know, there was, others have had their arms forced behind their back so tightly the blood's run from under their fingernails. You know, Jacques de Molay, James de Molay, appears actually to have gone mad quite early on, or, you know, lost his grip very early on in his incarceration, which ended up lasting from 1307 through till 1314, when he was eventually burned at the stake. And you're absolutely right. You know, there is an element of, you can clearly see in the trial testimony where torture has been applied, just in the answers that have been given, even in the ways they're recorded. It's not hard to read against this evidence and see admissions were being forced on the Templars with the specific target of discrediting the order to the point where it was no longer viable for the Pope, who was in some ways involved in this whole process, certainly in terms of rolling it out in other countries, where it's no longer viable for the Pope to keep the Templars going.
Yes, well, that's really interesting, because it all makes sense. You've got Philip in France carrying out this campaign against them, but it is amazing that it does spread to these other countries, and that Clement V, the Pope at the time, who in 1307 is in support of the Templars, within 5 years is damning them. How does that come about?
Clement V owed his position as Pope to Philip IV, ultimately, and he knew it. Never went to Rome, held his papal court in Poitiers and subsequently in Avignon. Troubled all his adult life with quite serious ill health, just not a particularly strong character, and with the knowledge that the last Pope who'd crossed Philip IV of France, Boniface VIII, had been slapped to death, and they were still talking about digging him up and putting him on trial after he was putting his corpse on trial. So it's got a lot of pressure on Clement V. Clement V, I think, realised that this was all hocus-pocus, but was being browbeaten by Philip IV. Tried to, and successfully did, stall Philip IV, because Philip wanted a lightning-quick rolling up of the Templars in the same way that in 1306 he had a lightning-quick expulsion of the Jews. He didn't get it because Clement V intervened to take control, in a sense, of the whole process of investigating the Templars and to roll it out across every other territory. Nightmare for Philip, because now it's the process was out of his control and ended up taking four years to from the point of the arrest to the point where the Pope at the Council of Vienne in early 1312 wound up the Order of the Temple. What we see in most territories when papal orders go out to start investigating the temples outside France is most people going, I mean, this is nonsense, you know, there's disbelief. Even in Cyprus, where there was some ambivalence because of local politics towards the Templars, people turned up at the Templar, the trial of the Templars, to give almost blanket evidence in favour of the Templars. And they quoted a famous saying on Cyprus, which was, I will defend you in the manner of the Templars, whether you were right or whether you were wrong. There was a sense that whatever the Templars had or hadn't done in the Holy Land, their probity was the one thing that really wasn't in question. But that was, you know, where Saladin had failed to destroy the Templars by attacking the individuals, Philip IV succeeded by attacking their values. And by the charges against them were clearly designed to show that they'd been failing to uphold their vows, their chastity, their poverty, their obedience, or that those vows were corrupting the order. And it was devastatingly successful because, you know, within 5 years of these charges being levelled, the Templars were gone.
And that's after 200 years, 192, somewhat short of this, yeah. And the order is suppressed and disappears.
It is a bit. I mean, there are sort of there are little ripples of survival in Portugal, where the Templars had been heavily involved in the Reconquista, claiming lands back from, you know, Muslim rulers on the Iberian Peninsula. No one wanted to roll the Templars up, and you know, the 1317, 18, 19, the Order of Christ was set up, in which former Portuguese Templars were kind of given new uniforms, new job titles, and allowed to carry on their business. So there was an element of Templar survival. We have accounts of individual Templars kind of running away, abandoning ship. There's a great account from the 1320s, I think, of two elderly Templars wandering around Palestine, seemingly not knowing that the order's been wound up at all. One of the reasons I think that there's so much attention has been lavished on the Templars over the years, particularly with regard to what I call the hocus pocus, is that people can't believe that this could have happened. They can't believe that an organisation this rich, powerful, large and widespread could have been rolled up and disappeared in the day. To which I've started responding, well, where's Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns? In our lifetime, 2008, gone. Right? Gone.
Yeah.
And that's shocking. And we know that the people who worked for those companies are mostly still alive. But it does happen, and it can happen. And it's not a matter of total disbelief that you have to create wild explanations for.
Yes, and the fate of many of the Templars wasn't quite so pleasant, in that many of them were burned alive.
Yeah, look, less than 100. I mean, I know this is cold comfort. Less than 100 Templars were burned. But the damage psychologically that must have been done to the Templars who were in prison for many, many years in very harsh conditions, just the shock of, you know, an organisation that you devoted your life to just being rolled up
and the shame because of the attack on their values.
Yeah.
And it's amazing all this is happening before Dante is writing that he puts Clement V in hell.
He does.
Being roasted upside down seems to say much about what happens to them.
He's roasted upside down for simony, though, I think. Weirdly, not for what he did to the Templars.
Oh, okay.
But you're right. You know, this is a very fertile period of medieval literature that is just about to dawn, Boccaccio and Dante and so on. And this is the world from which all that literature is born.
And let's just think quickly about legacy then, and particularly the fact that you have paid off, as it were, the mythology by being involved with Nightfall. So this is a new series that's coming out, and you've been a historical consultant. Tell us about doing that.
So just at the time I started writing the book, I read in like Variety or the Hollywood Reporter or something that Jeremy Renner, the actor, his production company, The Combine, had got a green light from the History Channel, A&E Networks, A&E Studios, for a Templar drama, and I was super annoyed. So I was like, now I can't sell the film rights to my book, right? I can't write my own Templars drama. So I got in touch with them and I said, look, I'm writing a book about the Templars. I'm here as a friend of the court if you want to talk about it, because I want to talk about it. And so we just, you know, I got to know the guys, mate, the creators and the show, and the, Dom Minghella, who's the showrunner. And then they asked me to, I started reading the scripts and just giving them historical notes, because the creators were very keen that although what they were doing was playing with the mythology, firstly of the Templars, secondly of the Holy Grail and the King Arthur legends and kind of blending those together, but they also wanted to hit historical beats, which was, by the way, in 1200, 1210, the Templars were appearing in the King Arthur stories. They were there. They were being turned into fantasy.
Even whilst they were alive.
Even while they were alive. Yeah. You know, literary legends in their own lifetime. And so that was at the heart of when I read the pilot script. And I thought, you know, actually, this is kind of interesting to me, because I had pushed away all of this mythology in writing the book. And I thought, well, here's a way to sort of scratch that itch and think a bit more about the mythology without having to put it into my book. And also, I was just fascinated by the process of how a kind of, I think the budget must be like $40 million, something like that, how a thing like that gets made. And I ended up consulting to it and working with the guys for about a year from pre-production through to the end of production, and still working with them now. And from start to finish, so, you know, from one script, two guys, to about 1,000 people working on the biggest backlot set in Europe, built out in Prague, it premiered in Cannes a few months ago. You know, I've seen through the process of building a big historical drama, and it's, yeah, you know, I'm fascinated by it.
Mm. And you've got your own series on this coming up as well?
Well, in the US, the history are serialising the book. It comes out September 19th in the US, and I'm serialising with them, and they've commissioned me to make 7 short films about the Templars, which I've written, and we're now editing. So that'll be out in mid-September.
Okay, great. So that's for US viewers. For those,
I think you'll be able to see we'll be able to see the films over here, and I'll put them on my Facebook page and all that sort of stuff.
And you've got an event coming up on the 21st of October with me, with History Masterclass, to talk about the Templars as well, for those who'd like to come.
If you want to know more about the Templars, I mean, yeah, I think, well, you've been running Masterclass for about a year, 2 years?
Just coming up for a year now, yeah.
And, I'm excited to do it. And I think I'll be talking about, God knows what I'm going to talk about. You know, once you start me going, we'll be learning. I think it's the Templars, but I'm also, as you know, very interested in story building and historical story building. So I think there'll be a lot of that involved as well.
Yes, so that's thehistorymasterclass.com if you want to find out more about that. But this has been a really fascinating conversation from my point of view, at least. And the book is wonderful. If you do pick this up, it's completely compelling and sort of rides along, and you'll learn all this history, but you'll have felt like you've just had a very entertaining experience along the way, which is perfect.
Thank you. Thank you for your wonderful questions.
That was Dan Jones in conversation with Susanna Lipscomb. The Templars is out now in the UK, published by Head of Zeus. In the US, it's due to be published next week by Viking. And Dan has also written a piece on the Knights Templar in the October issue of BBC History magazine, which has just gone on sale in the UK. Also in this month's edition, we have pieces on Edward VIII's First World War, Bloody Mary's Protestant Martyrs, the history of Indians in Britain, and the Anglo-Saxon Battle of Brunanburh. Look out for our October issue in all good newsagents and our many digital formats. Now, Dan Jones is also going to be one of the speakers at both of our history weekends in York and Winchester this autumn. While his talks have now both sold out, there are still tickets available for a number of others. You can find out more details and purchase tickets at historyweekend.com. And now it's time for this week's history news with our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
A debate has been reignited over the identity of a Viking skeleton whose remains were discovered in Sweden in the late 19th century. Researchers from Stockholm University believe that they have confirmed the 10th century skeleton found in the Swedish town of Birka in the 1880s is female. The remains have long been presumed to be male, largely due to a sword, axe, and other status symbols found alongside the body.
These artefacts have also led many to believe that the body belonged to a warrior. The Independent reported that DNA testing of the remains has led the researchers to conclude that this is the first discovery of a female, high-ranking Viking warrior, noting the skeleton's thin, slender and gracile bones as a further indication. However, Judith Jesch, an expert on Vikings and Norse history, has written that further justification is needed to confirm the bones as the correct ones for the gravesite before more light can be shed on the skeleton's warrior status. Meanwhile, the government has altered the route of a controversial road tunnel which is planned to bypass the Stonehenge World Heritage Site. A representative from Highways England told the BBC that the main difference to the proposal shared in January 2017 affected the western end of the 1.8-mile tunnel. Campaigns to rethink the route prompted an extra 50-metre shift away from the monument in order to avoid affecting the view of the stones at the winter solstice. In a joint statement, Historic England, the National Trust and English Heritage said that the change will ensure the winter solstice alignment, quote, will be unspoilt by lights and traffic from the road. While Transport Secretary Chris Grayling has stated the, quote, big decision aims to reduce traffic congestion and improve visitor experience, groups including the Stonehenge Alliance are still calling for, quote, a complete rethink amid fears that the tunnel may cause the site to lose its UNESCO World Heritage status. The proposals will likely now be subject to a lengthy planning process, and the BBC reports that the work is expected to start in 2021.
OK, so that's about it for today, but please do join us again on Monday when we'll be talking about the Ukrainian famine with Anne Applebaum.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.